Welcome to Tales of Ordinary Times, where we dust off the bookshelf of history to bring you stories of everyday places, objects, and people from the past. This is Dr. Ruth Colton, a historian and specialist in material culture.
Hello. And this is Emma Richmond, a history superfan whose expertise is in communicating new research.
Hello. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 7 of the podcast and the first episode where we have moved on from our parks mini series. So, this is very exciting. Today, we are going to be talking about somebody that you may not have heard of, but who has a really, really fascinating history. We're going to be talking about Gertrude Powick, who is a native of Stockport near Manchester and was a university graduate. She served in the First World War and she is absolutely fascinating. We are delighted to be joined today by Ruth's partner in crime, the co-founder and co-director of Our Stories Heritage, Kate Turner. Hi, Kate, how are you?
Hello, I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. You've joined us today because around the time of the 100th anniversary of the armistice, you and Ruth did an exhibition which featured Gertrude, didn't you?
We did, yeah. So the exhibition was to commemorate 100 years since the end of the First World War, and it was held at Stockport War Memorial Art Gallery. The War Memorial Art Gallery is really interesting in itself because it's actually the only art gallery that was built as a war memorial in the UK. We were brought in to do an exhibition which looked at the concept of memorialisation, why it had been built, why an art gallery and why in Stockport, and to kind of look at the history of memorialisation and to explore some key themes that might connect an audience that don't know too much about the First World War or are too distant from the subject.
That sounds really fascinating. And Gertrude was one of the stories that you picked out to talk about. How did you come across her?
Yeah, so we were looking at exploring characters through the exhibition. We didn't just want it to be historical. We didn't just want plain facts and figures. We wanted to find some characters who could create access points for different audiences. So we looked at the architect was kind of an obvious person to look for. But then we wanted to find some people who weren't just involved in the building of the space, but also the people who it was commemorating. So whether that was looking at a soldier and exploring their journey through the war, or in this case, a woman who wasn't involved in the military efforts, but in the kind of wider effort of war. We noticed her name on the memorial list in the back of the space. And we were also working at the time, there was an arts group who were creating dream boxes. The concept of the dream boxes was to look at unfulfilled or lost dreams of those who fell during the First World War. And one of those boxes was of Gertrude Powick. So it was a really nice introduction to see that people had recognised this woman and were starting to explore her story. And we wanted to get involved with that and see what she was about.
That's really fascinating. She sounds like a really, really interesting woman. Ruth, am I right that she came from quite an interesting family as well?
She absolutely did. She was born in Hatherlow near Stockport in Cheshire in 1887, and she was born to a family of nonconformists. Her father was a Congregationalist minister. He had studied extensively, had a PhD, had studied in Germany as well as in the UK. And he studied theology, and so he became a Congregationalist minister. And there was quite a large family. So Gertrude herself had two older brothers and two older sisters, as well as a younger sister. It's quite a large family, but the family was really interesting because, as we've remarked before with nonconformists, education was a really, really key driving force for this group. And nonconformists are a really huge part of the cultural fabric of Manchester. And education, as I say, was this real driving force. Gertrude's two older brothers were highly educated as well. Her older brother went and studied at Oxford, and her second older brother became a minister as well later on. And then also, she had these two older sisters, one of whom stayed at home, but her other older sister went on to university, which Gertrude herself also went on to university. So both were educated to a high level at school, but then took the very unusual step for this time of also going on to study higher education. They both went to Owens College. Owens College is now known as the University of Manchester, and they studied for their degrees. Gertrude studied modern languages, and then following that experience was able to put that education towards the various things that she did during the war.
We're definitely in the early days of women going to university. Just how unusual was it for a woman like Gertrude to get a university education?
This is really very highly unusual. So she's actually one of the very first female graduates of Owens College. It's a completely new pathway. And it's really not until after the First World War and after the suffrage movement really kicks off and some major changes take place that women really start taking on a position in higher education. And as we know as well, it takes an awful lot longer before they even get up to anywhere near parity with their male contemporaries.
Would her university education have been free, or was her father or her family paying to put her through university, her and her sisters?
University education at that time was not free, and indeed it would have been out of reach for most people. And indeed for this family, finances were of a real concern, not necessarily because they weren't well off, you know, they weren't members of the middle class, which they absolutely were, but because on a minister's salary, it didn't really leave an awful lot of room to play with. But with education being such a significant part of their identity, it was really, really important for them that they could follow this path. Luckily, there were scholarships to be won, and a number of the members of the family won scholarships in order to take them to university. So, for instance, her older brother, who blazed the trail for the whole family, became a distinguished medieval historian, and he was the first one to obviously win a scholarship.
He goes on to teach at Oxford, I think, doesn't he?
He does, yes. He gets a chair, he becomes a professor at Oxford, and then later becomes a professor at the University of Manchester, and then finally Queen's University in Belfast. So he really is this very well-respected medieval historian.
Gertrude doesn't take quite such an academic route, but she remains in education in some form. She goes on to become a teacher.
Yes, and that's far more expected of a woman, obviously, at this time. So while she was able to undertake this higher education, it still wouldn't have been possible for her to remain within higher education, teaching or lecturing. So instead, she becomes a high school teacher at the Manchester High School for Girls, along with a number of her contemporaries, actually. So again, it's this group of nonconformists who are really driving education and really keen to pursue educational pursuits. And the women quite often go into a role of teaching, particularly now that education for girls is prevalent as well. Remember that we had in 1870, we had Education Reform Act, which meant that children had to be educated for a certain number of hours a week. That's only, you know, a decade or so before Gertrude starts having her own education. And by the time she's graduated from university, she's got a position teaching modern languages at the Manchester High School for Girls.
It's interesting what you say about her not being able to pursue a career within academia. Going back to the dream boxes that were being made for the exhibition, her dream box was actually an office space within a university, because somebody had decided to look at her unfulfilled dream of becoming a lecturer and built her dream box to reflect that.
That sounds so beautiful. From everything you've said about the family, Ruth, it sounds like they would have pushed for her to be educated at university regardless of what she was going to go on and do. But in terms of career prospects for women at the time, if you're going to get a university education, what can you really do with that except become a teacher or an educator in some form? And like you say, Kate, you can't stay in academia, but the other options available to women, whether it's factory work isn't the type of work that that family would do anyway, the church wasn't open to her, she's almost too highly educated to become a secretary or similar. You know, there aren't actually that many options, are there, for a woman who's gone through university? There aren't that many choices.
And it must have been so frustrating. That's why I think that image of the dream box and her unfulfilled dreams is really powerful, because it must be so frustrating to have a number of your contemporaries be men and therefore able to access these other careers, and yet you, not necessarily because of your ability, but purely because of your gender, you are not able to access those same professions. And particularly within the family of both boys and girls being really driven towards education and yet having very different outcomes for all of them, you can see why she'd be frustrated at this and maybe trying to seek for change. That's something that she becomes really passionate about.
Yeah, absolutely. She gets involved with the suffragette movement in Manchester, doesn't she?
Gertrude was drawn into the suffrage movement, which is really happening a lot in Manchester at the time. So it's a family friend in Romley, which is in Stockport, and she introduces her to the Romley branch of the North of England Women's Suffrage Society. So the NUWSS was the driving force for lots of different branches, and they had a particular branch in Romley, which Gertrude gets involved with. It was in 1908 that she first starts getting involved, which is quite early on. The suffrage movement, as you said, had been really rumbling on in Manchester for quite a long time. It really was this hotbed of a desire for change, not least because women were so heavily involved in work in factories in the cotton industry. And there'd been a number of petitions by that point, cotton workers, where women had been signing petitions and campaigning for the right to vote. You know, this had all been going on for some time, but it had really started organising into branches by this point. And so Gertrude joins in 1908 with her friend, and she very quickly becomes a very active member, and she becomes treasurer of the branch, and later actually becomes secretary of the branch as well. She's a really key figure in that grouping.
Well, I should correct myself then, shouldn't I? Because if she's joined the NUWSS, she's a member of the suffrage movement, but she is not classifying herself as a suffragette. To be honest, that's one of my biggest bugbears, so I need to get myself, I need to sort that out.
You're right, and it's really interesting because we do quite often lump those groups together, and they are actually quite distinct movements, and it's certainly a lot more common, particularly in this early phase, for support to be for the more moderate suffragist movement, where they're not yet at the stage of campaigning for militaristic measures or undertaking protest in any really significant way, such as the suffragettes do at a later stage. But she does later on come into contact with women, particularly when she starts doing her wartime work. She comes into contact with women who have been involved in the suffragette movement instead. And they have some really lively discussions about it. And it seems that she's actually a very active person in talking about these issues. And certainly a lot of the men that she cares for, she talks to them about suffrage and about the idea. And she has to convince quite a lot of them that it's a good idea. She writes extensively as well about her feelings on the subject and how she has to deal with opposition to it in her day-to-day life. She makes note of the fact that while her sisters are all in favour of women's suffrage, her father is actually against it.
That's really interesting because he wants to educate the girls, but he doesn't want the girls to have the right to vote.
Yeah, and this is all part of that really strange dichotomy that is happening at this time where women are increasingly becoming more visible in society. Women are increasingly being able to do things like obtain a higher education, and girls are obviously being educated alongside of boys. However, at the same time, women are not being allowed to have the vote. It's a really strong and important discussion which is going on in the country at this time. And we almost think of suffrage not really being a big issue until the suffragettes start going on hunger strike in prisons and chaining themselves to railings and posting letter bombs. We tend to think of that being the really crunch moment, whereas actually these are conditions which have been simmering under the surface for quite a long time. Got a really nice quote which Gertrude wrote about, where she encounters a man in the street when she is leafleting and trying to promote the suffrage message. She refers to the creepy facetiousness of a man who she's leafleting. She says that a lot of the people were just icy, but this guy was almost the opposite and too much. She writes that he said, now, you know quite well, you're having me on, you know I won't sign. Now supposing now, as my wife were to have a vote, only supposing now, and she went and voted Liberal and me a Tory. Just think what would happen and how unhappy we should be. Why, I wouldn't ever be able to speak kindly to her again, and then she would be unhappy. No, you're having me on. You know the time. I will not sign it now.
He sounds like a lovely husband. And do we know any of her thoughts within her writings around suffrage, around that move that started with the WSPU breaking away and taking militant action? Or does she not talk about that?
So she attends something called a suffrage summer camp in the year which she graduates from the University of Manchester, so 1913. And some of the activities or the events which are put on there include things like how to protest effectively, how to do direct action. by this stage, this is just before the war breaks out the following year, and there is a real sense of a movement towards a more militant action. And she seems to be, if not actively signed up to that movement, she certainly seems to be thinking about it, or certainly having those conversations. And of course, by this point, she is also secretary of the Romilly branch. So she is having conversations with leading members of the suffrage movement in Manchester, such as Margaret Ashton, one of the biggest names in the suffrage movement in Manchester, but also is being brought into conversation with people like the Pankhursts as well. And certainly in the following year, when war breaks out and Gertrude is really overcome with this idea that she has to do something, she has to be part of something. And again, this is probably part of that drive and ambition she had to make a change, to do something different. And it's with the suffragette movement that she actually asks for their advice on what to do. And the suffragette movement, they are suggesting going into nursing, ambulance driving, lots of different activities that are more active and on the front line. She actually does consult with them.
Yeah, I just think it's interesting to get a sort of almost an everyday perspective on what it was like to be in the suffrage movement at the time from someone who isn't a Pankhurst or equally isn't a Millicent Fawcett, who we don't know of and who is going on that journey, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think as well, we can really characterise her as very much a thinker. I mean, obviously this is in part to do with her educational background, but it seems like through her writings that she was really very keen on having the discussions, with debating, with talking through these big ideas. And this stems right the way from when she was a university student. The circle that she moved in, we're all talking about these big issues of the time. She was well used to having discussions, having debates, and being able to hold her own. For her, this was part of her day-to-day experience, was all about discussing these big issues, and suffrage was a huge part of her day-to-day life.
And then, as you say, war breaks out in 1914 and a truce is called from a suffrage point of view. She joins the war effort.
Before she got involved in the front line of the First World War, she actually created some efforts on the home front. While she was still working at Manchester High School for Girls, she started a clothes collection for refugees of the First World War. I think it was while she was there that she was also practicing first aid and building some of the skills that would be so important when she did get to the front line.
Yeah, and she was desperately seeking for something to do, to be involved. One thing that's really striking is how many new skills she actively sought out in the course of trying to be useful. And we know that she wrote to her sisters about her desperation to do something, to be involved. Her second eldest brother was a minister and therefore exempt from war, but he ultimately did join up and become a chaplain on the front line. And she writes again of how relieved he must be to actually be able to do something. She was given a leave of absence for a year from her teaching. The very first thing she did was to do a nursing and first aid course. And from there, she wanted to volunteer for the Red Cross. She also went on to gain her driving license, which again, at the time, you know, there's not that many women have their driving licenses. But she was really proactive in seeking out new skills that she could gain, which might make her of some use on the front line. So you get a picture again of this real drive and determination to do something, whether that's running a drive for refugees or learning first aid, learning to drive. She wants to do something. She wants to be actively involved in the war effort.
So she's learned all these skills. Is she at the front line yet? Is she able to do her bit? Sounds like she has quite a frustrating journey to get to France and to achieve the thing that she's actually trying to achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. So she's not there yet. Even when her sister ends up helping support Belgian refugees, she's still not there. And she has a frustrating time where she does a typing course. She does a course to increase her mental powers of memory and acuteness. So she's trying everything she can to just be more skilled and more useful. She decides to brush up on her French. And ultimately, it is that which really helps her find work. She finally joins the Friends War Voluntary Relief Committee. So the Friends, obviously, we're talking about the Quakers, who are another nonconformist group. They have a particular viewpoint of war. Their perspective on it is that they are there to record it dutifully and to hold it to account. So they're not partakers in war for any reason other than to really hold a spotlight to it. They're pacifist, really.
Was I right that thinking that Quakers were pacifists as a rule?
Yeah, and so rather than standing back and being critical, they are involved, but in very much a less active military role. So she joins in a voluntary capacity as an ambulance driver and interpreter on the 11th of June 1915. It was her knowledge of French and her mental capacities, which they note, that really help her to attract their attention. they found that they could actually really use her in their program of relief work. So obviously there's a lot of people who've had to leave their homes in France, and they've often had to leave while still in their warm weather clothes. A lot of people have left, they've only got summer clothes on, they have no warm weather clothes, they have no beds. And the France War Relief Committee were providing support to those people. So they were distributing bedding and warm clothing. They were helping secure shelter and food, and also helping support the return to productivity of agricultural spaces. Gertrude basically has to use all of the skills at her disposal to support that. Interpretation is obviously one of the major parts of it, but so is also driving. She is an all-round member of the group who can turn her hands to many different important roles, whether or not that's driving people home, helping them get back across borders even, and helping organise the distribution of goods to help people to not necessarily return to normality, but to basically survive what was going on, even if they weren't caught up in the military aspect of war. War has a massive toll on country and peoples anyway.
Is this a common experience for women trying to sign up for the war effort, that it was this hard, as it were? Because everything that you hear about World War One, obviously on the soldier side, but even from the home front, women in factory work and women going out to the front line as nurses, it sounds like there was a desperate need. I don't think I'd really realised that it could be so hard.
We've got to really think about who these women are. These are not women who have the sort of skills necessary that really could be of use. So nurses obviously have a very clear role to play, but there is a lack of real fit for these women. So one of the roles that is suggested for women is secretarial and administrative work. But again, as we've already noticed, that's not really the right kind of fit for Gertrude. She's a highly intelligent woman. Yet she hasn't really been trained in terms of typing, although she does a course, but she's not really been trained for that sort of role. So actually, she lacks a lot of the skills that would be needed on the front line. And so she is very frustrated, almost because of her high education, that she cannot offer anything that she's really good at, until it comes to the fact that she is exceptionally good at languages. And she never actually does drive an ambulance. She just really focuses on the interpretation work, and she certainly does drive a car when she's out there. So she doesn't ever drive an ambulance, but she drives still when she's out there, and she does interpretation work.
Again, it comes back to the conversation we had about what does she do when she leaves university. It really feels like the women who were able to get that kind of education at this time were incredibly lucky in many respects, but when they come out the other side of it, it feels like they're overqualified for the society that they live in. Society's not moving fast enough for them to actually have a place in the world that they come out to once they have a degree.
That's completely it. And for Gertrude, that is so frustrating. She's absolutely desperate to do something. And so when she finally gets this role, she approaches the friends first. She's desperate. She's trying everything. And you can imagine how frustrating this is for her. She knows she's talented, and yet she cannot be of use to the world that she's really desperate to help. And she talks of it as an all-consuming passion, that she is so driven and she's so relieved when she can be part of this. And of course, don't forget as well that this war in particular, people really feel is almost a righteous cause. Britain standing proud, standing firm on an international scale. Gertrude is born right in the peak time for empire. She's surrounded by stories of the greatness of empire, of Britain, the empire in which the sun never sets. She's born into a time of utter fervour for the empire. She has this attitude towards this being this righteous war, this thing which is good and glorious for the country. And yet when her contemporaries, who are men, are able to go and make use of their skills and she cannot, she feels very much like she is pushed to the back. And Gertrude was not someone for whom a domestic life would have been the only option. She did actually have, I don't necessarily want to call it a flirtation, but she had a mutual affection for one of her university co-students, part of her social group. Her and this chap were very fond of each other. In the end, Gertrude puts an end to it because she can't see anything coming of it. It does seem very much like, while she was very, very fond of him and she sent him letters during the war and stuff, he ultimately died and she was very taken by that. A year after his death, she remarks on the anniversary about how much it affected her. But there was never any suggestion really that she would get married, that she would become a wife and mother. That wasn't necessarily something that was driving her. And so for her, the field of work, particularly in this wartime, of helping others, it became all consuming for her.
Kate, you talked about her gathering donations for refugees while she was still in Stockport, and that really seems like the thread. What she's interested in is supporting people who are affected by this terrible crisis that has just been landed on them through no fault of their own, through the movement of armies and where they happen to end up across the continent. And that feels like where her role really is in the supporting civilians.
Yeah, absolutely. And she did that in any way possible through the Friends of War Victims Relief Committee, who were very much involved in trying to support all efforts in France. So, for example, doctors who had been working in hospitals at the time were drafted to the front lines, leaving hospitals vacant and in need. The Friends of War Victims Relief Committee took over a maternity ward where Gertrude was very much involved in the running of that. Through the war, there were 981 births. You can just imagine what her role must have been there without the doctors and the essential medical expertise that would normally have been in place. So she was really always trying to support people and do the best that she could.
And that's such a key point as well of, you know, where there's been military conflict, that the situation has changed beyond all recognition, not just during the war years, but also after the war years. Things don't just return to normal. While in Britain, almost because the country was unmarked by warfare, the scars were almost more hidden because they were only within the people who were returning home from the front line. In the rest of Europe, this war had had an enormous impact. There was a lot more work to be done, the Friends group felt, beyond the end of war. So Gertrude didn't just return home the minute the armistice was signed. She kept going and she kept being part of the relief efforts long after the end of the war. One thing that she was really involved with was inspecting the conditions for returning prisoners of war. There's a lot of displaced people moving across the continent. And at the end of the war, there's a lot of sickness spreading because conditions in prisoner of war camps were appalling. And these displaced people moving to refugee camps and traveling in close proximity with each other could be desperately ill. Typhoid was a major, major concern. So the Friends group and Gertrude were really involved in traveling around Europe and inspecting conditions and seeing where they could help out. And Gertrude, with her modern languages, was a critical part of that role because her role as an interpreter meant that they could travel around and they could speak to people and they could support in every way. So, for example, some of the work they did was in Poland, for instance, they set up orphanages, they set up agricultural relief programs to help get farms back on their feet. Gertrude was also driving people across borders to try and get them home in the safest way possible, and then inspecting hospitals for people who were returning and treating some of these devastating illnesses which were around in Europe at this time.
So she's really putting herself at a lot of risk by taking on these roles. You know, she's interacting with contagious diseases and dealing with conditions that are far from sanitary. How is Gertrude feeling about that? How is all of this taking a toll on her?
Gertrude talks a lot in her letters about the conditions for other people. She seems to be very unaware of the risk to herself. She knows there are risks, but that's not her primary concern. Her primary concern is very much that there are people there who absolutely have to be helped. And she is driven by an overwhelming passion to help these people and really doesn't take her own life and her own health into consideration at all.
Yeah, because it was actually through taking part in these quite dangerous supporting activities that she fell ill herself. So whilst on a scoping trip, she fell unwell. And when she returned to Warsaw on the 3rd of December 1919, she found that she was unwell. Although even at the time, she didn't realise quite how unwell she was and quite how bad her condition was. At one point, making a comment that she thought it would be much worse than it was. But unfortunately, on the 20th of December, a couple of days after her 32nd birthday, she did pass away as a result of typhus. And it's just so young, isn't it? 32. And when we think about all that we've talked about here and all that she achieved and how caring she was, it's a huge loss as a result of war. It's not a soldier who died on the front line, but it's just as heartbreaking.
That brings Absolutely. Us really back to that role of her being commemorated in those war memorials. And I know that was one thing we were really struck by, was how, as a woman, she was commemorated, wasn't she? Because not many women were.
Yeah, exactly. It's really unusual. And the fact that she died outside of the actual wartime period, it was just outside of that time that she died. But she was just such a significant case and such a significant character to Stockport's history that she was commemorated alongside fallen soldiers in the War Memorial Art Gallery. And I think it's so valuable to have the letters that we've used to talk about today. We've discussed some of the examples and the things that she witnessed, but it's her language that really helped us to connect and helped us to understand the sort of woman that she was. And it's her language that we use to present to the public in our exhibition. Those words like desperation to help, and we wanted to communicate that through her character profile in the exhibition. There is a series of characters. As I mentioned, we used an architect, but we also had the mayor of Stockport at the time, and his language was very much more duty and sacrifice. But the way that she really came across to us and the way that we wanted to share her story was in that real assistance and help and so little awareness for her own safety.
You're totally right that she was such an important figure in Stockport's history at the time. And I think that's really echoed by the fact that she was commemorated in the Manchester Guardian as it was then. Her eulogy that's in the Guardian features the text of her last letter. So this was published only just after her death on the 29th of December. It's quite long, but I'll read a couple of paragraphs of it because you're totally right, Kate, that her words say really everything you need to know about the type of woman that she was. So she talks about being in Tarnopol in welcoming refugees who are making an attempt to try and either return to their home or escape from their home. And she says, Tarnopol is one of the biggest centres for receiving these refugees. I think it's one of the saddest sights I've ever seen, for they have come in hundreds, sometimes in thousands, and there is no wood or coal to heat the barracks where they are put. There's no soap to wash them, all their clothes, all the rooms they're in, and they're in a filthy condition. There's no clothing for them, and most of them have no underclothing at all. They're all huddled together for warmth and lie on a sort of wooden bed built in and along opposite sides of the rooms, and there are no blankets at all. But the worst of it is that the typhus cases have had to remain with the others, as till yesterday there was no hospital for them, and although there was some sorting done, many stayed in with the rest. Which, of course, is exactly what killed Gertrude herself.
Yeah, and it's again, isn't it? She's saying them and their situation, and the fact that she would have been in that situation in the end is...
Yeah, really sad. One other thing I found in the Guardian archives is a letter of memorial written to the editor of the Manchester Guardian. And again, I think this shows how well her friends knew her. A letter was written to the editor of the Manchester Guardian from the former Women's Union of the university, of which she'd been a member. It's a short letter, but what it says is that the members of the Women's Union wanted to commemorate Gertrude's life by raising money for the cause that she had been working for in Poland. They say the urgent needs in Poland are well known. May we appeal through your columns to all her friends who would care to join the Women's Union in this effort. Contributions of clothing or money will be received. And they felt that that was the best way to commemorate Gertrude's life. And from everything we've heard about her today, I think they were absolutely right that that's exactly what she would have wanted if she couldn't help herself, to know that at least, at the very least, her death had helped to raise more money and more contributions to help the people that she was trying to help.
You really do get a sense of what might she have accomplished if she'd been able to return home having done so much, and how the world might have changed. I mean, obviously, by this point, women had been granted the vote. Some women had been granted the vote, and there was still a lot more to be done, and the world was very much changing. You know, and you wonder how she would have found her role within society and what other boundaries she might have pushed as well, because the situation she left when she did finally leave home was very different to the situation she'd have been returning into. It's very easy for us to pigeonhole things like the suffrage movement and women in the war into very neat categories. The picture was so much more diverse and nuanced. People were individuals, and Gertrude Power is a wonderful example of a woman's individual thinking, her individual drive and determination, and how that could be thwarted because of society at the time, but also where she could find herself and the huge difference that she could make.
Absolutely. And she will have made a difference to so many individual people's lives, even if it was just through showing kindness. Not that many minutes ago, we were talking about how frustrated she was in trying to get to France. And once she finally got there, she did a phenomenal amount. You know, I think the dream box situation of an academic office is, I can definitely see her in that. But I almost wonder, you know, in 1918, as you say, some women got the vote, but women were also for the first time allowed to stand for parliament. And I almost wonder if that's how she would have ended up changing the world if she'd lived.
One thing, her letters are really quite amazing in the way that they provide this picture of things going on, but also she provides a lot of self-analysis and quiet examination of feelings within the situation. So it's a real personal account of her own viewpoint on things. And you really do get a sense that she would have to do something else because she felt within herself that it was part of her own identity. So yeah, politics or any sort of campaigning, more than anything, she really just helped to change the way we viewed women because of women like Gertrude Powick, who then ends up being commemorated alongside men who fought during the war. It really helped to open the nation's eyes as to what a woman could achieve, not just academically, not just as a teacher and educator, but as a human being, as a force of nature, which she undoubtedly was. She achieved so much, and it would have been almost impossible for stories like hers not to move people and not to get the sense that they deserved more. And you can just imagine that man who gave her so much grief over how he would never sign the petition calling for women's suffrage. If he had met her after the war, if he had learnt of all that she had done and achieved during the war, what would have his response been then, and how might it have been different?
More importantly, what was his wife's reaction have been? As you say, Kate, Gertrude is commemorated in the Stockport War Memorial Art Gallery. I believe she also has a blue plaque now. Is that right?
She does have a blue plaque. It's on her home in Romilly. It's outside the house there. But I think as well, she features in the University of Manchester's War Memorial in the University Quadrangle.
And I think she may even be the only female listed there as well. So she has broken a lot of barriers with memorialisation.
That brings us to the end of the podcast and really quite an emotional journey. Thank you so much, Kate, for joining us. It's been a real pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fab to talk to you both.
And we always have a section at the end, which we call our further reading, which is if you've been inspired by what you've heard about today, and I hope that you find Gertrude inspiring. Some recommendations from us to you of things you can do or things you can read. I think the first one is definitely to visit one of the places she's memorialised, whether it's her blue plaque or the Stockport War Memorial Art Gallery or the university, obviously when it's safe to do so. Ruth, there's a whole book about Gertrude, isn't there?
There is a book written by Gertrude's great niece, Susan Paris. And the book is called Displaced by War, Gertrude Powick and the Quaker Relief in France and Poland, 1915 to 1919. The book is beautifully written, really taking into consideration her correspondence, which really is quite beautiful. Obviously, the author has a lot of family connections, so she has unique access to her written word. But it also really does provide a lot of detail and context to the situation she was in. While we've really focused on her mentality and her actions, there's a lot of background information there about the Quaker Relief group as well. So it's well worth a read.
That wraps things up for today. We will be back next week with a brand new subject and very much a shift from some of the difficult things that we've talked about this week. Next week, we are going to be talking about the history of the pineapple. Might seem like an unusual topic, but it's a fascinating, fascinating story. And we really were obsessed with pineapples a couple of hundred years ago. So you will be surprised and delighted by everything that we have to tell you next week. And we will see you then. Bye-bye. Tales of Ordinary Times is an Our Stories production and is presented, produced and edited by Ruth Colton and Emma Richmond. To find out more about Our Stories, visit www.ourstories.co.